This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyu Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
She says women are abandoned by their families. Mothers of children with albinism are blamed for their condition and often banished from their communities.
That's VOA's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up also. There's an ongoing dispute over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam between Egypt and Ethiopia. We will have a discussion on the matter. And concerns about the coronavirus has forced the postponement of the inaugural Basketball Africa League season, which was to start later this month. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, there is an ongoing dispute over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam between Egypt and Ethiopia. The U.S. has sponsored and observed negotiations to help reach an agreement. This dam, upon completion, could be Africa's biggest hydroelectric power plant and provide Ethiopia and some neighbors with huge amounts of electricity and energy security. Egypt, however, is concerned the dam could significantly lower the amount of water in the Nile River, which supplies the majority of Egypt's water. It wants the dam to be filled more slowly than Ethiopia plans, saying that will reduce problems. Now, tensions have escalated between Ethiopia and Egypt, with both countries vowing to do what is necessary to protect their interests. Ethiopia has said the U.S. position on the controversial Nile River megadam is totally unacceptable. VOA senior White House correspondent Patsy Wirakusuwara has been following the situation closely. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Patsy.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Let me start out by asking you, where do things stand right now? What's the latest?
The latest is a phone call that transpired between President Donald Trump and President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi yesterday morning. So that's Tuesday morning, Washington, D.C. time. Now, we heard about the phone call mostly through Egyptian media, and the White House did not give a readout of the call until much later during the day, after I pestered them several times and essentially was not very forthcoming about it, basically just saying that President Trump expressed hope to President Sisi that an agreement on the dam would be finalized soon. Now, as you know, what happened the week before was essentially Ethiopia walking out of what was supposed to be the last 2 days of the final round of negotiations between Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan, hosted by the U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, the point person that President Trump appointed to handle this matter. So it was supposed to be the last day of negotiation on Friday. They were supposed to come up with an agreement. Ethiopia walked out. The Trump administration came up with a draft agreement that Egypt supported, but Ethiopia basically said, you know, we did not agree to this. We want nothing to do with this. This is undiplomatic. Stop pressuring us. The same thing that happened as well on Thursday was that several dozens of American Ethiopians, the diaspora, protested in front of the State Department saying that the U.S. should stop its pressure campaign against Ethiopia. So that's where we stand today. The parties are no closer to the issue as when they first started negotiations in November in Washington, D.C.
And what is precisely America's role in the matter? Negotiator? Observer?
So this is really interesting. Ethiopia and Egypt and Sudan have been negotiating for years, and the State Department the U.S. State Department have been involved in the matter since 2011, but have always said that, you know, this is a matter for the three parties to resolve. However, in September of last year, President el-Sisi met President Trump and asked him to mediate the conflict, to which President Trump said yes. Now, we do not know what the U.S. interest is on this, but essentially President Trump said, yes, we're going to get involved. He appointed Secretary Mnuchin. And so the three parties agreed that the U.S. will be there in negotiations in Washington, D.C. as an impartial observer together with the World Bank. But sources tell us that last week, Ethiopia basically said to Secretary Mnuchin to stop being, to keep, remain in your role as a neutral observer and do not come out with draft agreements, which they did. And Secretary Mnuchin said that, nope, we're going to continue with this issue. And that's when Ethiopia backed away, saying that this is not what they signed up for. The U.S. was supposed to be a neutral observer, but they've overstepped their roles.
And lastly, the two countries vow to do what is necessary to protect their interests. What does that mean? I mean, some fear this could lead to war. Do U.S. officials think it could come to that?
Well, right now, the White House has not given us further indications about this. We do not know the substance, you know, the details of the conversation that transpired between President Trump and President El-Sisi's phone call yesterday. We do know that President Trump did also call the president of Ethiopia, the prime minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed. Several weeks ago to try to resolve the matter. But yes, this is certainly a conflict that could easily get out of hand. This is something that the U.S. does not want to start up. But again, we don't know what the U.S. interest is in this matter. Why is President Trump in particularly very interested in this issue that's very far away from the U.S., that essentially, you know, the U.S. hasn't been interested before beyond, like, just making sure that there's no geopolitical conflict coming out of the region.
VOA senior White House correspondent Patsy Wida-Kusawara, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
Lawyers in Guinea-Bissau tell VOA's Portuguese service that the country's courts have been closed for several days by soldiers occupying court offices. The presence of the troops comes as the Supreme Court of Justice considers an appeal of the December 29th runoff election. The Electoral Commission has said Umaro Siciseko Mbalo won, although the runner-up candidate and others have appealed to the Supreme Court. The court has ordered a full audit of the vote, which the Electoral Commission has not done. Mbalo has been sworn in and today met with the Prime Minister. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he is concerned about the electoral dispute. His spokesman said Guterres encourages all stakeholders to await the decision of the Supreme Court and to prevent any acts that could undermine peace and stability in the West African country. A report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council finds women with albinism and mothers of children with albinism suffer disproportionately for discrimination and stigmatization. The genetic disorder is most prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Ikponwosa Ero, a Nigerian activist who is herself an albino, became the Human Rights Council's first independent expert on the enjoyment of human rights by persons with albinism in 2015. She has done much to eliminate pernicious myths surrounding albinism. Her new report describes excessive abuse and discrimination women with albinism or mothers of children with albinism suffer because of their gender. She says women are abandoned by their families. Mothers of children with albinism are blamed for their condition and often banished from their communities. She says women with albinism are physically attacked and accused of witchcraft. She says they suffer sexual violence on various grounds, including the belief that such intercourse can cure HIV/AIDS.
Mothers of children with a condition are stigmatized right from the birth of their child with albinism and throughout life. Major barriers to access to health ostracize these mothers and expose them and their children to poverty and further human rights violations.
Albinism is a rare genetic disorder characterized by the complete or partial absence of pigment in the skin, hair, and eyes. It is particularly prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa. Those with the condition often are killed for their parts, which some believe can transmit magical powers. Such beliefs are widespread in countries such as Tanzania, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. ERA wants countries to act to end racial discrimination and institute policies to end harmful practices, particularly those centered on accusations of witchcraft and ritual attacks against women with albinism. She says special programs should be put into place to help these women and their children out of poverty through training so they can earn an independent living. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
15 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Concerns about the coronavirus have forced the postponement of the inaugural Basketball Africa League season, which was to start later this month. The NBA-backed 12-team league had been due to tip off on March 13th in Dakar, Senegal, but has now been put on hold. The league did not say when the games will start. Seven nations, Egypt, Senegal, Nigeria, Angola, Tunisia, Morocco, and Rwanda were to host games during the inaugural season. The coronavirus has been found in four of those countries so far: Tunisia, Morocco, Senegal, and Nigeria. The first confirmed case in Senegal was announced just this week, and with the first ball games to be played there, the league had little choice but to call off plans to play. Worldwide, more than 92,000 people have been infected and over 3,100 have died, the vast majority of them in China. At least 70 countries report cases. The World Health Organization says to contain the virus, people with cold and flu symptoms should stay home, and everyone should wash their hands frequently. Major countries are rapidly dedicating hundreds of millions of dollars to fight the virus. In Zimbabwe, the Harare City Council has issued thousands of summons to residents in a bid to recover the $900 million that the municipality says they owe for services. Residents call the efforts unfair. Reporter Kuzaza Nawashi has the details.
Michael Chideme is the council spokesperson. He explains the decision to summon residents.
We have done 10,000 summons. We are doing them because we are owed huge sums of money by people who are not willing to pay. So we think by issuing them with summons, they will be compelled to pay.
Lorin Mupasiri is the director of the Combined Harare Residents Association. She questions the fairness of the summons.
City of Harare currently does not have a stable billing system. They have not explained where they got those bills, but City of Harare didn't have any way of billing residents. The billing system of City of Harare has not been functional, notwithstanding also the fact that most of the bills, especially water bills, were being based on estimates because most suburbs receive water like once a week, while others have gone for years without any water. In terms of administrative justice, those summons are not fair, and it just doesn't make sense.
Mupasiri says residents have been billed based on estimates. Some parts of Harare have been without water or refuse collection for years, yet they have still been receiving bills. Mupasiri says while they encourage residents to pay their bills, they should only pay for the services they get. Chideme says the billing system is functional and summons are reasonable.
It has not been done since August. Our billing system is working. They are very fair because the same residents are demanding services from council, and council has to find money, needs the money to provide the services that people are clamoring for.
Council says it is owed $900 million, money which council says could be channeled toward improving service delivery that residents yearn for. Council has said it has been very accommodating by inviting those served with summons to engage council and agree on a payment plan that works for them. However, those who don't pay up risk losing their properties, which would be sold to pay their bills. Mupasiri says for residents to pay their bills religiously, council will need to be more transparent in its expenditure of public funds and do away with scandals. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
Today, the U.S. State Department presented its annual International Women of Courage, IWOC, Awards, honoring 12 women from around the world. Now in its 14th year, the award recognizes women around the globe who had demonstrated exceptional courage and leadership in advocating for peace, justice, human rights, gender equality, and women's empowerment. U.S. embassies around the world nominate candidates for the award, and senior State Department officials select the finalists. They go on to participate in a visiting leadership program around the U.S. The awardees range from a defense lawyer in Azerbaijan to a woman from China who spoke about against Beijing's treatment of its Muslim minority communities and includes two women from Africa. Award recipients Claire Idiara-Ogo from Burkina Faso founded an organization focused on ending female genital mutilation and promoting the empowerment of women. Dr. Rita Nyanpinga from Zimbabwe was recognized for her work over more than 35 years to promote gender equality in the workplace. Kenya police have called on residents of the country's northeast along the border with Somalia to do more to help them combat Al-Shabaab militants. The Islamist terrorist group recently launched a series of deadly attacks on schools, civilians, and security, including a joint Kenya-U.S. military base. The call, made to Kenya's Parliament Security Committee, comes a day after the agency that recruits teachers vowed not to deploy teachers in counties along the Somali border. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The debate on the future of education in northeastern Kenya has entered the corridors of parliament. As teachers seek transfers to areas outside the region, the Teacher Service Commission, an agency tasked with training, hiring and placing instructors across the country, said 42 teachers have been killed since 2014 at the hands of Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The head of the commission, Nancy Masharia, defended the withdrawal of teachers from the terror hit areas in the northeast.
It's true that the children need education, but their teachers are also entitled to life. Life is sacrosanct.
In January, three teachers were killed when Al-Shabaab attacked Kamuthe Primary School in Garissa County. In 2018, five teachers were killed in Wajir and Mandera counties. More than 20 teachers were killed in 2014 when a bus they were travelling in was hijacked by Al-Shabaab. Responding to questions from the parliament members, the Inspector General of Police, Hilary Mutayambai, said residents of Kamuthe village were aware of the attack in advance.
Even the attack of those teachers, it's only the non-local teachers who are not aware about that attack. The students themselves and the other teachers, during the material time of the attack, they were absent. We have argued the local component is very important to complement the security operation.
Mutayambai called on the local leaders to talk to their people and to encourage them to work with security forces to fight Al-Shabaab. George Musamali is a director of the Center for Risk Management in Africa. He blames security agencies for some of the problems in the area.
Locals are looking at who is the lesser evil. Because if you see the way we operate when you're in that area, especially the government security agencies, they will go in that area and use brutal force against the locals. That is why, as much as we are saying that they are cooperating with the Al-Shabaab, there is a high possibility they are not cooperating. What they are doing is just turning a blind eye to the activities of Al-Shabaab, not reporting them, not sharing intelligence with the national government.
Mohamed Dahir is a lawmaker from northeastern Kenya. He says authorities must find a way to keep the schools open.
When you give up to them, to their demands, and you close schools basically, or you end up deploying out teachers from that area, you have left those children and those people to the whims of Al-Shabaab. And we feel this is extremely unfortunate and totally unacceptable.
The education of some 10,000 school children in the northeast hangs in the balance as the local and national leaders search for solutions. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Wool and mohair are the bread and butter to many farmers in the tiny nation of Lesotho. But the industry was driven to bankruptcy after Lesotho's government struck a deal with a Chinese entrepreneur. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Maseru.
Wool and mohair have been the pride of this tiny mountain kingdom for centuries. But a recent change in the nation's system of brokering sales has wrought havoc on this industry. It all started, says the founder of the National Farmers Union, Mulalefi Motiane, when a mysterious man came to town in 2012 and tried to get a foothold in the industry. Motiane dismissed the man, a Chinese businessman who identified himself as Stone Shi.
Who is this guy? How can he pounce on me on this? Does he have any respect of people? So I then said to Stone Shi, no, I am able to handle my business. I don't need you. And he walked away. I never, unfortunately, got to get him. In hindsight, this was a mistake on my part, to be able to find out who this fellow is.
5 years later, she secured a deal to broker all of Lesotho's wool and mohair exports. Parliament codified that system into law in 2018, giving Xi's company, the Lesotho Wool Center, a monopoly. The result, Motiana says, was catastrophic. An untold number of farmers remain unpaid for wool they sold in 2017. He himself has a warehouse with an estimated $500,000 of unsellable wool. Motiana considers himself lucky. Other wool growers have fared worse. Local media reports some farmers have taken their lives.
Some of them have died. Lost their lives. We've lost some of them. They have not been. Let us remember that this is a 1 billion Maluti industry, the wool and mohair. Stone Shi was an individual like this finger of mine. Would any government, would any country agree to hand over such an important industry to a single individual?
Xi's office did not respond to VOA's request for an interview. Finance Minister Moketsi Majoro says the government erred in giving Xi the deal.
This is a mistake that we have recognized and have moved quickly now through legislation to remove. So we have now opened up the brokerage business to several players. So they have applied, and then there are several brokers now that are dealing with wool. And we have opened up the market to say you can sell any way you like.
Before Xi's company took over, all of Lesotho's wool and mohair exports were sold through brokerages in South Africa. Economist Emmanuel Latete says he understands why the government wanted to shift the business to Lesotho, but says the policy needs review.
It might have had a good intent, but the problem was how it was then introduced and implemented in the market. Did we involve the relevant stakeholders so that they understand the direction the economy was taking? And that involvement, to me, from discussions I've had, might have been limited.
That's definitely true for these men, who came down from the mountains to try to sell their sheep and goats in the capital. At this point, many of these animals are only good for meat, since the wool won't sell. These men didn't want to talk, Motiane explained, because talking, they said, doesn't put food on the table. Anita Paul, VOA News, Maseru.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.